You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in an uncertain time, do you have a familiar object that brings you some comfort, some luck? We'll talk about lucky tokens from friends, cherished lucky sweaters, and more. First, people around the world are dealing with the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic. For some, it's the often devastating physical effects of contracting COVID-19. For many others, it's feelings of loneliness, anger, anxiety, or sadness. A new online course at Oregon State University offers anyone the opportunity to examine the emotional and psychological effects that can occur even without contracting COVID-19. More than 3,700 people are enrolled, and it's free for anyone, anywhere to take. Regan Gurung is one of the instructors for the course. Regan is executive director of the Center for Teaching and Learning at Oregon State and professor of psychological sciences. He spent 20 years at UW-Green Bay. He's a frequent guest here on Central Time. Regan, good to have you back.
Hi, Rob. Great to be back. I'm glad we can talk about this course.
And Catherine Becker-Blees is with us, associate professor and director of the School of Psychological Science at Oregon State University, and came up with the idea for the course, I understand. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, I'm sure you were scrambling like, professors and teachers everywhere to move online as this epidemic emerged. You were in the early stages there in the Pacific Northwest. What led you to want to create this class and then make it available to all of us?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We were scrambling because we saw all the cases in Seattle, and we're just down I-5, just down the road from Seattle. And as we were moving to remote, we knew our students were going to have a real challenge psychologically in terms of motivation and in terms of what were these hastily put together remote courses going to look like in terms of their grades. And so partially we were looking at the psychology community across the country who was actively mobilizing a lot of resources to be ready for the psychological effects. But also we were thinking about our students, and we thought we need a course for our credit-bearing students, but also for everybody out there in the world. Pass, fail, everybody can take it, and we'll just put together a team of people and just kind of see how it goes. Because, of course, we didn't know at the time kind of where we would be even today or where we would be a month from now. So, you know, a combination of wanting to help students and wanting to give psychology away to the broader community.
And, Regan, what are some of the common reactions to living in such a strange and uncertain time?
I think, you know, one of the things right off the bat that you see is with the loss of control, there's a lot of fear. And I think fear is probably the number one element that we find ourselves talking about. There's discomfort, there's anxiety. And I think starting maybe even as long as 4 or 5 weeks ago, there were reports both from students and colleagues about how there are times of the day when you get frozen, when you can't think, when you just don't feel good. And we take all of those things head on in the course and provide some tools to deal with them.
And Kathy, let's talk about this idea of punching through pandemics. Sometimes we think in our lives of unreasonable fears and anxieties. In this case, we're dealing with very reasonable fears and anxieties. How do we take things like this seriously without being overwhelmed?
Right. So, you know, I think I posed that exact question to a clinical psychologist in New York City who was on, and she said something really wise, which said, you know, we don't actually have all the answers. This is something we're figuring out together. But the best answer we have so far, for me anyway, and from psychology, is that you have to try to separate the productive worry from the unproductive worry. So if you're worried about something and that caused, like checking the statistics or checking the news, and that causes you to be better prepared, you know, to get, you know, to buy some food but not stock up on all the toilet paper. If you find that it's helping you prepare, go ahead and worry. If the worry is just keeping you up at night, you're stockpiling things that aren't necessary, then those are worries to let go. The challenge, of course, is that it's changing hour by hour practically what is actually productive and what's not productive. And so that process is chewing up a lot of our brain power right now, but that's still the best answer we have to deal with these worries that keep propping up.
And that moving target, Regan, that Kathy was talking about, seems like part of the challenge in and of itself, the uncertainty, the, you know, what are things going to be like tomorrow, in a week, in a month?
Well, I think, and you know, something we find ourselves, a topic that we often come back to almost every week, in some way or the other in the course, is this distinction between, the two main types of coping that's out there. There's, approaching the situation and avoiding the situation. And I think for many of us, avoiding the situation to keep the emotions at bay seems to be something that we have a tendency to do. And what the psychological science says is, you know what? Avoiding something actually in the short run is okay, but it's not necessarily a good thing to do in the long run. And I think that's really tough. It feels good to not have to think about all that fear and distract ourselves. But by the same token, there are some times where you just have to make some changes, and that's going to be better. And I think we're seeing that right now as higher education everywhere prepares for the summer and the fall. Is now we've got some time. What are we going to do to make things better for us as we move forward?
We're talking to Catherine Becker-Blees and Regan Gurung. They're both psychology professors at Oregon State University. They are part of the team behind this online class, Punch Through Pandemics. Kathy, do you have thoughts for people who are more directly affected? They've been through the illness itself or watched a loved one with it, or they've been hit by job loss in this time when so many people are losing jobs. Are there things that that they can do that can help them cope with that difficult, direct situation?
Yeah, so for the people who are more affected, coping is definitely more challenging. And I think the what's being suggested for people who are more directly affected, including the frontline health workers in the more affected cities, as well as the groups you talked about, is to focus on values. And then you can't always plan your day. You can't even always do what you want to do. You might hit that block, that wall Regan's talking about. But if you return to what your values and then try to align what actions you do take during the day, whatever the circumstances are, with those values, that's really the best way to move forward when there's so much uncertainty and grief and loss. It's the basis of some psychological therapy. It's the basis of research. So we return to your values. You can write, you can read, you can do different things to discover what those are and live in that space until we get to the point where you can plan and you can act again. That's our suggestion.
Regan, if people want to get involved with this class, I know there are lectures online and other materials. What do we have to do?
All you have to do is go to punchcovid19.com, and all the instructions there are in front of you. If you want, you can just listen to our guest lectures. We have some great experts talk. We have two happiness experts on there. We had an expert on video game design who actually told us about the best video games to play during the pandemic and why it could actually be good for you. So yes, kids listening, if you keep getting told to not play video games, you may want your folks to listen to that special guest because she said some things that many of us adult parents, I think, were surprised by.
Well, so I can't leave that hanging, Regan. Can you name a name or two of video games?
Well, actually, yes. This was the creator of something called a video game called Super Better. One word, Super Better. And I would actually say start right there, because Super Better is a video game that takes psychological science and you play a game with it and it helps you cope. And she actually released a special pandemic version that includes fun little excursions such as household and yard scavenger hunts and little challenges. So yeah, Super Better right there. Check out Super Better. Download it. It's free. And it's a video game that helps you flex some psychological muscle.
And Kathy, before I let you two go, can you talk about the response you've gotten from the many people participating in this online class?
Yeah, well, I do think we achieved the goal of putting stuff out there for a variety of audiences. There's some folks who just kind of drop in and read and are on the sidelines, and then we have a really dedicated, involved group of students earning credit who are in the course, and then and a few times we've had a few people from the community join our course live, and so the people are really appreciating having a place to go to, and they really appreciate the practice. There's a lot of mindfulness practice there that's really relevant right now. So, it's just the opportunity to get together, talk to other people, engage in a variety of different ways.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
And Regan, good to talk to you again.
You too, Rob. Take care.
We've been talking to Catherine Becker-Blees, Associate Professor and Director of the School of Psychological Science at Oregon State University, and Regan Goering, Executive Director of the Center for Teaching and Learning at Oregon State and Professor of Psychological Sciences. They're both instructors for this online course we've been talking about, Punch Through Pandemics with Psychological Science, that's free and open to the public. You can find it at punchcovid19.com. We also have a link up at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up, four-leaf clovers, grandma's old sweater, a small token to keep in your pocket. Do you have an object you like to keep close for luck? We'll hear from you and talk with a reporter about a few items that bring people comfort. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you have such a thing. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Department of Education is out with new rules on how universities can investigate claims of sexual harassment and assault. We'll find out what's changing and how it could impact students. First, regardless of how superstitious you are or not, you might have an object that you keep or wear for luck. Sometimes when we find ourselves in unfamiliar or uncertain territory, having something familiar around us can make us feel better, whether it's a little something you keep in your pocket or an item of clothing that's special to you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there an item in your life that's kind of a lucky charm for you? Something you wear for the special date or the big job interview that you think might bring you luck? Something that you keep around maybe during the Packer game? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Guy Trebay is a style and culture reporter and critic at the New York Times. He wrote a piece titled, "We're Holding Tight to Our Good Luck Talismans." Guy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what is it about this moment now with this coronavirus at the top of all of our minds that makes a lot of people reach for these good luck talismans, even if we're not normally superstitious?
I think that in times of really great uncertainty, people reach for good luck charms and talismans because it gives them the sense of control, when in fact none of us has any control, basically.
You talk to some people in the fashion industry and elsewhere on kind of your normal beat, and some big name people and successful people, a lot of them had stories of their own good luck charm. What kind of things did you hear from people?
You know, it was very interesting to me that regardless of who one talked to, everybody had something that they reached for. And this originated in me sort of, I can't say exactly reaching for the worry beads, but all of us feel a little bit out of control. And for example, Francesca Epithiatrov, who's the creative director of high jewelry for Louis Vuitton, she has a talisman, a lucky charm that belonged to an aunt of hers whom she loved, and she keeps it at her bedside. And this is reassuring to her. And there were all manner of things across all faiths, across all kinds of interests. And it wasn't really, even people who were kind of not superstitious officially felt that they got a lot out of having this thing and being able to touch or feel or be connected to the idea of luck and people they may have known.
And it's not necessarily people think, if I have this in my hand, better things will happen, luck will happen. It almost seems more like an item of comfort than a superstition. Is that something you found?
Yeah, I mean, it's been studied a great deal that both social science and medical science have studied the idea that just by thinking in this way, it has a physiological effect that's beneficial. But I think that it's just having a sense of being connected to something besides yourself and being outside the moment and being part of a longer story. That was that was sort of the top line on the reporting.
Now, a lot of us have things like this when we're kids. You know, I had a blanket for another kid. It might have been a stuffed animal or something. I don't know. Do you think that's part of it, like trying to reach back to the sort of thing that might have comforted us in childhood?
I think it's connection to family, frankly. And almost everybody I talked to had something that was given to him or her by a family member, whether it was an aunt or their mother. There was a guy who's the chief financial officer at Theory, has a small prayer book in silver that his mother gave him that is with the Hindu god Hanuman on it. And it's just having it in his palm felt very reassuring. He felt connected to his mother, wherever she may be. I think it's important, it feels important itself in doing the reporting, that everybody wanted to have a sense of being part of a longer story, that this thing would end and that they were connected to something beyond before this and beyond it.
You heard from a couple of people who have things that seem like mundane objects. I think one was a casino chip. One was a folded dollar that somebody had given her. Could you share a couple of those stories?
Absolutely. The thing with the dollar, which is in a variety of cultures, it's both Talmudic, it exists, and it's in South Asian Muslim faith that you, in a kind of compressed way, you give somebody this dollar. It could be anything. It could be a pack of a small bag of coins, and they carry it, and it means that they're on a mission of faith. And when they return, they give the dollar to someone else, and they've been kept safe by whatever the great higher power you may believe in is. The casino chip, I don't know. It's just a random thing.
It seemed like, yeah. Now, you talked to different behavioral science professors about this and the author of a new book on superstition. Can you share some more of what you heard from, you know, the people who research these kind of behaviors?
The basis is that we don't have control and that anything that makes us feel is, I mean, we don't in a general sense, but we don't specifically in this. And since the danger is invisible, it's unknowable in so many ways. Anything that even in a gestural, in a daily way, makes us feel as if we have control of the moment is calming, and that's one of the few benefits that we have available to us is to try to become calm.
We're talking to Guy Trebe, style and culture reporter and critic at the New York Times. We're talking about a piece he wrote on lucky charms, lucky talismans, those family items we keep around for comfort, especially in a difficult time, even if we're not necessarily superstitious ourselves. Guy, can I put you on the spot? You mentioned, I think, metaphorically reaching for the worry beads. Do you yourself have objects like this?
Oh, yeah, I got plenty of them. And I'm the most rational person you'll ever meet who has every possible superstition. So, you know, I have, beads and various things. I have a knotted cloth rosary that I'm not a religious person at all, but I had this knotted cloth rosary that got in a monastery in Bucharest, and I found myself reaching for it, more or less as one would worry bead, something to hold in your hand, and it's settling. It's physiologically settling, and it's psychologically settling.
I'm not a superstitious person in general, except I guess when I am, my things tend
exactly.
to be, I fear the power of the jinx. So if I see, you know, good news, better statistics coming out in COVID-19 or something, I always say, well, you know, knock on wood or so far, hope that continues, and try not to somehow not acknowledge the positive news for fear that acknowledgement makes it go away. Is that something you encountered yourself or the people you talk to?
What I thought was interesting along those lines is that I interviewed the head witch at the oldest occult store in Manhattan. And when she talked about what she's right freaked out as everybody is, she's at home. She said, you know, we're all kind of in a panic and can't go out and all the stuff, you know. And she said, but some of the things, they're not quite superstition. Some of the rituals that you can enact are in every faith, you know, light a candle, sort of do a candle, sort of a purifying of your house every day. There's definitely no harm in it. And you know, it was interesting to see how across faiths, across every possible boundary, this exists.
I got to say, I feel a little silly mentioning my jinx thing here. And that makes me wonder, as you asked all these people, again, in many cases, you know, professional people in high profile jobs about their lucky charm, were they reluctant to own up to this?
No, far from. Everybody had one immediately.
Interesting.
Everybody had one.
And since you wrote the piece, have you had people coming out of the woodwork to say, "Yeah, here's mine"?
I kind of wish I had, but I can't, in honesty, say that I have.
Now, another thing. I don't have the physical object myself, but I think my lucky charm that I reach for at tough times is routine. I end up trying to follow the same patterns, and that's kind of what makes the world feel like a normal place in difficult times. Is that something you encountered in talking to people?
I'm sorry to interrupt. That kind of goes to this thing that Stacey Rapp, who's the head witch at the occult shop, was saying, is that, you know, these kind of ritualizing of daily, you know, the habitual things feels controllable. And anything along those lines, I have a routine, I guess many of us do in the morning, and I do my whatever things I do on my phone, and I do them in a set order. Is it superstitious? I don't know. Is it calming? Definitely.
So do you feel like you learned lessons in kind of maintaining calm in these tough times from the people and the experts you talk to?
I think that it is you know, what I mainly learned is that it cannot harm you.
Fantastic, okay. Guy. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Guy Trebe, a style and culture reporter and critic at the New York Times. We talked to him about a piece he wrote titled, "We're Holding Tight to Our Lucky Talismans," for the New York Times. And we want to hear from you. You can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page now or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Do you have that lucky something? The casino chip, the folded up dollar, the sweater from a loved one or other artifact, maybe a family Bible or prayer book? Is there something you keep around that gives you some kind of comfort, especially in difficult times? Whether or not you're actually superstitious and believe it's a lucky charm or not, that's okay. Let us know. Again, tweet us at Central Time WPR or head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and tell us about it. Tell us what it is and what it means for you. Love to see what you have to say and maybe share it on a future show. Don't be shy. And again, when sports happen, do you have that lucky charm you want to keep around, the lucky jersey you have on during the big game? For my group of friends and I, for a while, it was a big, strangely large can of green beans that we'd shake when the Packers needed luck. I don't know how that came about. Coming up, we'll find out how new Title IX rules from the Education Department, the Federal Education Department, could affect the handling of sexual assault allegations on college campuses. These are a couple years in the making now. And now universities dealing already with the COVID-19 pandemic and shutdowns have about 3 months to formulate their response and implement new rules. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 8 on The Morning Show, the pandemic is putting a strain on people's mental health while making it harder to access treatment. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the resources out there, including crisis lines available by text, phone, or online. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Department of Education released its final list of changes on Title IX enforcement. It focused specifically on how universities investigate and judge allegations of sexual assault and misconduct on their campuses. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos says the rules, which came out in first draft form in 2018, are meant to strike a balance between protecting victims of sexual misconduct and the rights of the accused. She says guidance issued by the Obama administration went too far and resulted in unfair suspensions and expulsions of accused students. Opponents of the new changes say fewer protections for victims could have a chilling effect on people speaking up about harassment and assault. Sarah Brown is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's been covering this issue for quite a while now. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we dig into the new changes, let's go back to, in some ways, the beginning of the story, the changes made under the Obama administration. Can you give us some background on that?
Sure. So what we're talking about here is the Dear Colleague letter, right? So that was released in 2011. That's when the Obama-era Education Department's Office for Civil Rights basically told colleges, hey, you need to take campus sexual assault seriously, or we will put you under investigation and add you to our list of shame that we're going to release to the public on a regular basis. So this letter essentially told colleges, here's how you should be investigating and deciding cases. So colleges need to use this particular standard of evidence when deciding whether someone committed a sexual assault. This new letter coincided with growing student activism on these issues too. So more students were coming forward, telling their stories of how they'd been sexually assaulted and how their complaints had been mishandled or ignored by their colleges. So that's kind of what was going on. The impact of this Dear Colleague letter was huge. I mean, it transformed the way sexual misconduct was handled on campuses. It prompted colleges to formalize processes. A lot of them have hired new staff members devoted to this work. And there's no question that colleges are taking student victims more seriously. And people on college campuses are talking about these issues like sexual assault and consent far more than they ever had before.
That said, there's been pushback from Betsy DeVos and others. What were some of the concerns that were raised that ultimately led to this revision now that's just out?
That's right. So there has been a lot of criticism. So for years, people have been sounding alarms about the Obama-era Title IX approach because they felt colleges were setting up systems that were essentially biased in favor of victims. So, for instance, the guidance told colleges to use the preponderance of evidence standard, or more likely than not, to decide whether a sexual assault took place. And the critics said that low bar allowed students to face serious punishments like expulsion, even if the details of a case were kind of unclear, like alcohol or drugs were involved and memories were hazy, which is quite common in these cases. So Secretary DeVos comes into office in 2017, and she said, you know, I believe students, particularly men, are getting railroaded by these unfair processes. At least that was her perspective. So she said, I'm going to change things. I'm going to make due process for the accused more of a priority. And with these new rules, that's exactly what she's done.
Talking to Sarah Brown from the Chronicle of Higher Education, looking at new rules from the Federal Department of Education on how universities and colleges handle accusations of sexual assault and harassment. All right, we've set the stage here, Sarah. Can you give us some of the key changes in this, I think you wrote, a 2,000 or so page document?
Yes, so there are a lot of pages to get through, and I haven't even gotten through all of them yet. But for colleges, perhaps the biggest change, and this was an expected one, will be required hearings and cross-examination for sexual misconduct cases. So that means the students involved both get the opportunity to question each other about what happened. They are not going to be questioning each other directly. Each student will bring an advisor to the hearing. The advisor can be an attorney, but doesn't have to be. So that advisor is the one who's going to be asking the questions of the other student. I'll also add that the new rules do allow colleges to use technology to keep the students separate, so they don't have to sit in the same room during the hearing. That's pretty common already. So advocates for required hearings and cross-examination say that's necessary to get to the bottom of these murky allegations. And they say it will give accused students the chance to stand up for themselves more than they have in the past. So on top of that, another big change is a narrower definition of what constitutes sexual harassment. So under the Obama administration, Title IX covered all unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature. Now, that's pretty broad. The change is now the definition says Title IX covers, quote, conduct that is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it denies a person access to their education. So technically, that means colleges aren't responsible under Title IX for investigating sexual misconduct that doesn't meet that bar.
If, Sarah, I'm running a university or college right now, what do I have to do and how soon do I have to have this in place?
So the official date for colleges to be in compliance with all of these new rules is August 14th. So that's basically 3 months from now. The idea is that the changes would take effect around the start of the next academic year. That's obviously a quick turnaround and, you know, there's a pandemic happening. So colleges are pretty busy trying to figure out, are we going to open this fall? How are we going to implement social distancing and how are we going to bring our students back? Now they're going to have to revamp their sexual misconduct policies, too, and educate students, staff, and faculty about what the changes are.
Right. One of the changes for staff and faculty has to do, and I want to dig into this a little more, with mandatory reporting. The idea that if somebody comes to you to relate a story that involved sexual assault, say on campus, many staffers and faculty would have to report that up the channel. What changes when it comes to that?
So essentially, the new rules say colleges no longer have to designate most of their staff and faculty as mandatory reporters. The language they use is responsible employees. Essentially, the rules don't force colleges to do that anymore. That had been the approach under the Obama administration, basically saying, hey, colleges, you need to have everybody report to the Title IX office the second they learn of something, because that's how we're going to stop cases from getting swept under the rug. I've been talking to college officials about how they're thinking about that change. Most of them are telling me they think mandatory reporting will continue to stay in place because colleges have spent the past decade training their faculty and staff and, you know, student resident advisors and dorms too. They've trained everyone, you know, the second you learn of something, report it to the Title IX office. There's been this culture that's grown around mandatory reporting. And so most of the officials I talk to tell me they're going to stay the course. But I will say the mandatory reporting culture has faced some criticism because professors, for example, often develop close relationships with their students, and they say that they've had to, you know, stop private, intimate conversations like abruptly and say, hey, just so you know, student, I have to report everything you just told me to the Title IX office, and then that can be uncomfortable and betray the student's trust. So that's kind of an additional layer here. But at this point, what I'm hearing from colleges is that they're going to keep their mandatory reporting policies in place.
Sarah Brown is with us from the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're talking about new federal rules on sexual misconduct claims and how they're handled by colleges and universities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story? What do you think of the old guidelines and how they're being changed over the next few months? Are you concerned, as some critics are, that they'll result in fewer actual cases of harassment and assault being addressed? Do you think previous rules did put due process in jeopardy? If you are a student or work on a campus, what's your take on all of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Sarah Brown from the Chronicle of Higher Education, looking at federal rules being put in place, changing how colleges handle claims of sexual harassment and assault. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reaction to these changes or your questions about what they're going to mean on campuses. And if you are working on a campus, if you're a student, what do you think about the way cases like this, sexual assault, sexual harassment, have been handled in the past? Call 800-642-1234. Now, Sarah, we heard about the backlash, you told us, to the Obama-era rules that led to these changes. What are we hearing now from groups concerned about these new changes and the impact they'll have?
So we're certainly hearing from victim advocates who have been concerned about these new rules for a long time. They're very concerned that they essentially roll back the protections that the Obama administration put in place for student victims, and that they just really erase a lot of progress that they feel colleges have made on these issues. Colleges are concerned, too. They have done a lot over the past decade to encourage more students to come forward about sexual misconduct. They're afraid that the prescriptiveness of the new hearings and the cross-examination is going to be intimidating to many students and prevent them from coming forward. So that would, you know, reduce reporting of an already underreported crime. So those are some of the concerns that that both victim advocates and colleges have. Victim advocates are also worried that the federal government is sort of letting colleges off the hook, right? Because we talked about that narrower definition of sexual harassment under Title IX, a lot of things that colleges have been investigating, technically they don't have to under Title IX investigate those cases anymore. And there are a lot of people who say the federal government is essentially letting colleges off the hook for a lot of sexual misconduct that happens on campus just because it doesn't meet this higher bar. At least that's their concern, even though colleges say we're going to stay the course and keep investigating a whole range of misconduct.
Let's go to our callers now. Will is with us in Platteville. Will, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was just going to comment. So I'm a faculty member and someone who studies some of this sexual violence, dating violence. And one of my personal biggest concern with the new laws is, or the new Title IX regulations, is the decreased reporting and willingness to report. However, I am somewhat glad to hear that the mandatory reporting is at least changing. It's my experience that it takes away the choice to and the power from the victim to make their own decisions when so many decisions and personal choices have already been violated for them. And it's kind of a bit of a mixed bag, but that is maybe the one glimmer of hope in my view.
Interesting. Well, thanks for the call. Sarah, what do you think?
Well, that's exactly what I would expect because some people, while they laud mandatory reporting as a well-intentioned policy, they say that it has caused issues. It has broken trust in some cases, between professors and students. And I will say some colleges have kind of retooled their policies in recent years to try to address some of those concerns. So they've reduced the number of faculty and staff members who are considered mandatory reporters. But there's no question that these new rules will give colleges more latitude to go that route and to decrease the number of mandatory reporters if they choose. Now, of course, there will be concerns that arise if they do so, because, you know, what if a faculty or staff member learns of allegations, doesn't report them, and then something even more serious happens? That was, you know, the kind of thing that the policies were designed to prevent, and that could certainly be something that that crops up again.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Nate now in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you. This is actually one of those situations where I think both sides can have a pint. There is underreporting. On the other hand, once it is reported, people should have a fair hearing, and I'd certainly want them to have that. From both political and personal, and a separate political point, Kathy Young of ARC Digital wrote that there's a certain ironic justice to Biden and Democrats facing what she details in a good commentary, very questionable allegation that she thinks is true, but they have to deal with it in the situation that they supported.
Nate, thanks for the call. We've talked some about the Biden allegations. I want to stick with campus. So how, Sarah, in our last minute, do you see campuses trying to thread the needle now under these new regulations?
So I'd say that colleges are trying to figure out, you know, what this all means for them. The administrators I'm talking to say they're not just going to drop the ball on sexual misconduct that doesn't meet this new narrower federal definition. They feel a moral obligation to create safe campuses for students, but they're going to have to figure out sort of what the rules mean for them in that context. In addition to that, you know, small colleges, community colleges without a lot of staff and resources, they're going to struggle to put in place those required Title IX hearings and cross-examination. You know, on small campuses, for instance, everyone knows each other. It's hard to pull together a neutral hearing panel of faculty, staff, and students when it's that intimate of a campus community. On top of all of that, COVID-19 has caused colleges to lose millions, in fact, in some cases, tens of millions of dollars in expected revenue. And so now colleges are going to have to put in place these changes when they're struggling financially. And I think that's certainly going to be a challenge. You know, I will say a lawsuit has already been filed to challenge these new Title IX regulations, and it's possible that a court injunction could delay their implementation. But at this point, colleges have got to be in compliance by August.
Thanks, Sarah, for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Sarah Brown, reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, joining us for a look at new rules from the Education Department on campus claims of sexual harassment and assault. Despite calls from some to hold the 7th Congressional District special election entirely by mail, on May 12th, voters will go to the polls. Democrat Tricia Zunker faces Republican Tom Tiffany in a special election for the state's vacant 7th Congressional seat. As Rob Mentzer reports, Tiffany is promoting his record in the state legislature and his support for the president.
Tom Tiffany has been a state senator since 2013 and a state representative since 2011. He voted for major GOP policies like the Act 10 law that weakened public employee unions, and he's taken the lead on deregulating Wisconsin's mining industry. But Tiffany has put something else front and center in his campaign for the 7th Congressional District, his enthusiastic support for President Donald Trump.
I will stand with President Trump.
I'll stand with President Trump.
And it's why I will stand with President Trump.
President Trump.
President Trump.
President Trump needs proven reinforcements in Congress.
The 7th Congressional District is a mostly rural, mostly conservative district that includes Tiffany's Northwoods State Senate district. In the fall, after nearly a decade in Congress, Sean Duffy resigned from the seat. Duffy was a strong ally of Trump, and Tiffany is campaigning on a promise to continue that.
Hey, Andrew, so can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Just want to make sure we've got the audio on also.
On a recent video chat with Trump campaign volunteers, Tiffany started the call by touting the Twitter shout-out he'd gotten from the president.
I had the chance to talk to President Trump earlier this week, and as you saw, he officially put his endorsement out via Twitter, as the president does, and I can't thank the president enough for that endorsement.
Trump's approval ratings have slipped in Wisconsin, but the president remains popular in the 7th district. Wisconsin Democrats feel they have a strong candidate in Tricia Zunker, the Wausau School Board president and Ho-Chunk Supreme Court justice. Tiffany alluded to Democratic energy when he spoke to the Trump volunteers.
The other side is motivated. They're out there working. We need to match that intensity, match that effort.
Tiffany has roots in northern Wisconsin. For more than two decades, he and his wife ran a river cruise for tourists in Oneida County. His conservative backers, like Eric Bott with Americans for Prosperity, say Tiffany's record in the legislature reflects the priorities of his district.
Senator Tiffany has really tried to be a voice for the Northwoods and northern Wisconsin throughout his time in the legislature.
Bott says Tiffany has pushed policies to help loggers, farmers, and other industries in his district.
He's been a voice for economic recovery in the North.
One of the biggest legislative fights of Tiffany's career was over a mining project that never happened. Tiffany led efforts in the state legislature to change Wisconsin's laws to help encourage the mining company Gogebic Taconite to establish a massive open-pit sulfide mine near Crandon. At the time, Tiffany said Wisconsin should jump at the opportunity to establish a mine in the North Woods.
It is rare that any state gets a company that says, we want to invest $1.5 billion in your state. What a shot in the arm, and we can do this in an environmentally safe manner.
Environmentalists disagreed. The project earned Tiffany political enemies among conservation groups. Tiffany would later call their opposition a badge of honor. Both his supporters and his detractors say the fight was a window into Tiffany's priorities as a legislator. But in the closing months of this year's campaign, that has taken a distant back seat. Voters are focused on the COVID-19 pandemic. On the call with Republican volunteers, Tiffany said he wants to be in Congress to help the economy recover.
2020, when I was talking to people, was going to be their best year ever for many people. We need to restore that confidence.
He says a big part of that is reducing regulations so that the private sector can thrive. In a nod to President Trump, he says he's running to help return America to prosperity. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tom Tiffany is the Republican candidate in the special election in the 7th Congressional District. You can hear a profile of his opponent, Democrat Tricia Zunker, by visiting WPR.org and hear interviews with each candidate at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up Monday on Central Time, Wisconsin Congressional Representative Mike Gallagher joins the show for a look at a U.S. contract for frigates built in Wisconsin and what it means for the region's economy. Wisconsin isn't the biggest state for wildfires, but they do happen here, and there's been a high risk in recent weeks. A state safety expert tells us about those risks and how you can help prevent them. And we'll find out how the pandemic is changing the way people vote around the country, including more and more moves toward mail-in voting. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday at 7, get two takes on efforts to reopen parts of Wisconsin's economy with a Republican leader in the state legislature and Democratic Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. That's Monday at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Community cookbooks used to be a common tradition, and our guest says it's time to bring them back. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.